Hello, and welcome to the Curiosity Cast. I'm Karen Ward. And in a moment, my conversation with Todd Henry, the author of a new book called Die Empty. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about this digital post-it note I have on the dashboard of my laptop. It reads, date of my death, Thursday, March 20th, 2053. And below that little post-it note is a counter that's counting down to the date of my death. And today it reads, 39 years, 6 months, and 10 days until I die. When these little death reminders pop up every week or so, it's a bit like getting a small electrical shock, especially now that my years lived are greater than my years remaining. Of course, I don't actually have any idea when I'm going to die. This random estimate that I'm working with is based on actuarial tables, my family history, my current state of health, and frankly, my sheer will to live a really, really long life. And I don't love thinking about when I'm going to die. I don't think many of us do. But I will say that having this constant reminder of when I'm likely to take my leave is pretty motivating. I have a lot of great work I want to get done, many, many places on the planet I want to see, about 1,000 books I want to read, questions to ponder and think about, moments to savor, and of course, people to cherish and love and spend my time with. So when I think about all of this potential impact I might have, connections I could create, and experiences to enjoy, if I think about it as a tank of gas, well, why wouldn't I want to just run that dry before I go? So my conversation with Todd has reinforced how important it is to live a full and juicy life that's just bursting with curiosity and wonder and action so I can die empty. So that's right. Today, we're talking about death, and it will be in the most affirming, inspiring, and motivating way possible, I promise. I'm delighted to have Todd Henry with us, who is the author of a great book called The Accidental Creative, and a fantastic new book called, that's right, Die Empty. Todd, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy launch schedule to chat with us today about how we can die empty. Welcome to the Curiosity Cast.
Karen, thanks for having me. It's so great to speak with you.
So I think my very first question, because this is a really provocative book, the title is kind of confronting, and I'm wondering where the book project came from. Where did the idea come from? Why did it feel important to write it and share it now?
Because I believe that the purpose of systems and practices and structuring your life and all of these things that I go out and I work with companies and individuals and helping them do, all of that is about nothing more than making sure you're getting your best work out of you, your most important work out of you. But just being really, really efficient is not the ambition unless you're also being effective in doing the things that really matter to you. And so with Die Empty, what I wanted to do was challenge people, listen, you have a limited amount of four things. I always say your fate determines your fate, right? Your focus, your assets, your time, your energy. You have a limited amount of all of those things, and how you choose to spend them will ultimately determine your success or your failure. And whether you realize it or not, you are today in this moment, you're building a body of work. And that body of work will stand as a testament to what you really valued, what you really believed in. At the end of your life, that's the thing you'll point to and say, this shows what I cared about. And that body of work, by the way, Karen, isn't just your job. It's any place you expend any of those four things, focus, assets, time, energy, in order to create value in the world. So it's your relationships, your family, it's how you go about your work. It's all of those things. That's what comprises your body of work. And so what I wanted to ensure was that the message gets out to people that, listen, you are going to, at some point, you're going to look at that body of work and it's either going to represent what you care about or it's not. The choice is yours. But ultimately, my goal is to get to the end of my life not having taken my best work to the grave with me, but instead having gotten it out every day because I was intentional about where I was spending those four things.
Love it. Now, this body of work concept I really like. That was a concept that resonated really deeply with me as I was reading through the book. And one of the things I think that people struggle with, certainly in the work that we do, we hear this a lot, both from individuals and organizations, is figuring out, well, what is the work? So I'm wondering, like, what your advice is if we don't know, if we're not clear, you know, to use your language, what battles we're meant to fight and audiences or people we're meant to serve, how do we proceed? Like, how do we get started on that journey of you know, a brilliant body of work that we're just so proud of throughout our lives and certainly at the end of our life?
Well, I think we begin with the wrong question. I think a lot of people start with the question, what would I like to do? Right. Rather than asking the question, what work am I willing to suffer for? Which really, that's at the heart of it. That is the core of the word passion, the original root of that word means to suffer, right? In the original language, we tend to use passion to mean this enraptured ecstasy, right? I am constantly in this state of perpetual bliss when I'm doing my work, but very few people ever, well, if anyone ever actually experiences that all the time in their work, right? There are always things that we have to do that we don't like to do. The question is, What in your life are you willing to push through that suffering for in order to see an outcome that matters to you? Now, that doesn't mean work should be misery. No, of course not, right? And it doesn't mean that you should always feel like, I'm going to work today. No. What it means is that people who are most engaged, most satisfied, most passionate about their work are solving problems that they deem to be worthy of their focus, their assets, their time, their energy. And they devote their life to solving those important problems. Friend of mine, Cal Newport, wrote a book called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And in that book, he challenges, and it's primarily written to people who are maybe early in their career, right? He says, we tend to want to make decisions about our life's purpose and our life's arc when we have the least available information we'll ever have, right in our life, which is totally true. And he challenges people, listen, people who over time discover passion in their work are not people who start off sticking their finger in the wind and asking, what would I like to do? Instead, they devote themselves to solving problems and they develop skills. And over time, they find their passion for their work growing. And I took a very similar approach in Die Empty. I believe that what you have to do is you have to apply yourself to problems, develop your skills, figure out what you're naturally good at and the problems you tend to be naturally drawn to. And over time, you'll begin to identify patterns and say, wait a minute, when I do this thing, I seem to be disproportionately effective and I seem to be adding a lot of value that other people don't seem to be able to add. And my passion seems to well when I'm engaging in this activity because I find it beneficial, useful, and personally gratifying. So you can't sit around thinking about what is my purpose in life. You only discover those. And by the way, there is no purpose in life. I think people have purposes, right? There are multiple things that they contribute. And I think there are any number of paths you could take that would be contributive and valuable and all of that. But I think that you don't get there by sitting around and thinking about it. You only get there by acting, observing, and then redirecting.
I love that. It sounds like it's really more a process of discovery. I almost feel like it's like an onion, like you keep peeling back the layers until you get to, which, you know, you get more and more focused and clear as you act and do the work and reflect on what aspects of it you love, what aspects of it you didn't, where you, like you said, created the most value and where you struggled, as opposed to, so it's discovery based as opposed to like divine intervention. Like you just wake up one day with a thunderbolt and ta-da, or put the finger in the wind and say, I figured it out now.
That's exactly right. And I use the analogy of film developing in a dark room, right? It's like over time, as you watch that film develop, not that anybody really even knows what that is anymore, but as you watch that film develop, you start to see patterns and you start to notice things. But it happens slowly over time and eventually a picture emerges. But it's not like a digital snapshot where you just take the photo and boom, oh, look, I can see the whole thing. That's not the way it works. You have to pay attention. Little clues will develop over time. You have to nurture those clues, follow those clues. And eventually you'll find that you're operating in more of your sweet spot if you do that. But if you're constantly jumping the tracks, following every whim, then you won't ever get to a place where you're contributing the kind of body of work that I think most of us desire to contribute.
Now, what you're describing takes patience and attention and focus, and that feels maybe a little contrarian given how sped up our world is, you know, in terms of access to information and how quickly we can, you know, interact with one another and get things done. What kind of feedback or pushback maybe are you getting about that idea of patience and taking time? And it is a life's work, not, you know, a year's work or even less. I feel like our attention spans are even so much shorter than that.
Agree completely. And yeah, I do get pushback. I think people The pushback that I get, I think mostly, is when people say, that's nice, but I don't have time to pay attention to that kind of advice, right? Because it's about tomorrow's results, not about next week's results or next month's results. And you know what? That's fine. And I talk with my publisher about this. I said, listen, I'm not trying to write a book where I tell everybody this is a blueprint for how you should live your life. What I'm saying is, listen, here are principles that if you ignore them, you are more likely than not to have regrets at the end of your life. And that's really what I wanted to do, was provide a framework for people to minimize regrets later in life for how they spent their focus, their assets, their time, their energy. And so, of course, people are going to try to shortcut to success. They're going to try to do whatever they can to try to reap a harvest that they never planted. I mean, that's just human nature that's going to happen. What I am telling you, and I can almost guarantee for certain, is that that is not a path to a deeply gratifying life. It's not a path to being able to point to a body of work at the end of your life and say, I'm proud of that because I put the time into it to build something I'm proud of. And also, I learned a lot about myself, about others, about what it means to work, not just on a what, but to work on how and why I do that what as well.
I want to make sure I get you to talk about the three different kinds of work that you address in the book, because I not only love your passion for alliteration, because I share that love, but you've made it very easy to sort of hook into these key concepts. And the three different kinds of work I thought were really nicely expressed. And truly, since reading the book, I think about every day.
Right.
So take us through that, because that was a really, I think, key important part of the book for me.
Sure, I'm happy to. Yeah, so the three kinds of work are mapping, making, and meshing. Mapping, of course, is planning your work. It's strategizing. It's figuring out what needs to be done and when in order to be successful. So it's basically planning. It's thinking about the work. Making is actually doing the work. So it's writing or designing or sitting with a client and actually engaging in all of the plans that you have made over the course of time. Right. That's making. So at the heart of it, making is actually doing the work. Now the problem is, it's really easy to measure your making, and it's really difficult sometimes to measure your mapping. So people often throw themselves into the work because they can check tasks off of lists, but sometimes they neglect mapping for the sake of making, because it's easier just to throw yourself into the work. But there's a third kind of work that is neglected even more, and that is meshing. And meshing is all of the work that is between mapping and making. It's all of the work that pulls together or develops your skills or allows you to engage your work more effectively. So it's things like personal growth, following your curiosity, identifying the themes that drive your life, right? Building into your relationships, your relational connections, finding your voice and taking risks and trying new things. All of these things comprise meshing. The problem is that in the hustle and bustle of daily life, it's really easy to neglect meshing. And the majority of the book, Die Empty, is about that meshing process and practices that people can build into their life to make them more effective at meshing so they don't neglect it.
And what do we miss if we're not meshing? Because you said it's the often the most neglected, which obviously means it must be a bit harder to do if people are sidestepping it. What do we miss in our life and our work if we aren't actively, consciously doing meshing type work?
You don't exercise your full potential. You don't develop your skills. You rely on existing skills. You don't develop your intellectual capacity. You rely on what you already know. You're not following your curiosity, which is, I know, a topic that's near and dear to your heart,
we'll
right?
We'll get there. Yes, for sure.
You're likely to get off the rails in terms of what matters to you, the kind of work that you're doing. So there are kind of four profiles that we can fall into as it relates to mapping, making, and meshing. I believe the most desirable profile is what I call the developer. And the developer is someone who is mapping, so they're strategically planning, they're making, they're getting the work done, they're disciplined about that, but they're also meshing, they're developing their skills, they're doing all of the work between the work that positions them to have a platform to be effective. They're weaving together opportunities as they arise because they're positioning themselves to be able to do so, because they're engaging in all three kinds of work. When you map and you make, but you don't mesh, you fall into what I call the driver profile. And the driver is really great at planning and they're really great at getting the work done, but they're relying on yesterday's skills to do today's work. They're not developing their capacity to engage their work in new ways. They're not learning new skills. They're not pursuing their curiosity. They're not really building into their relationships beyond what's required to get the work done. And so they're driving, they're getting a lot of results in the short term, but over time, their effectiveness diminishes because they're not developing new skills to deal with the new kinds of work they're required to do. Making and meshing. So if you're really good at making, which is, you know, doing the work, and meshing, which is, hey, I'm actually developing myself. I'm developing new skills and thinking about my work in new ways, but you don't map. It's what I call the drifter. And the drifter is the person who bounces from project to project and thing to thing, but they're not really strategically planning how all of those things are going to come together. So you see a lot of half completed projects in the wake of the drifter, right? Because they just kind of bounce from thing to thing, and they're really disciplined about making, about doing the work, but they're not strategically planning where it's all leading. And as a result, they end up drifting from thing to thing, whatever catches their fancy on a given day. Meshing plus mapping. So you're building into yourself, and you're doing a great job of that, and you're mapping, you're planning, but you're not making, you're not engaging in the work itself. That's what I call the dreamer. And we all know these people, right, who have big plans, and they're out there and they're pursuing their curiosity and they're developing skills. And I mean, this is the person who can speak like five languages, and they know everything there is to know about how to launch a venture. And it seems like, you know, every day they're out learning something new and they're developing all these plans, but they've never actually launched something. You know, well, this is the dreamer. This is the person who can't bring themselves to actually do the work. And this is a real problem, of course, because you've got all of these skills, but they're latent unless they're put into action. So those are the four profiles: the developer, which is the desirable one, the driver, the drifter, and the dreamer. And so ultimately, if we're good at building disciplines into our life to help us map, to make, and to mesh, then we're positioning ourselves to better approach our work as the developer, or as someone who is weaving together opportunities, skills, passions into valuable work. And that's really what the developer does.
Now, I'm assuming I recognize myself in two of those, not the developer, sadly, although I aspire to be more of a developer. Where do you feel like you fit in those D styles?
Oh, it's so funny because my wife read a version of this before it went to my editor for the final edit, and she said, "You are so the drifter. That is so who you are," right? It's totally true, because yeah. I love to plan and I love to mesh, but sometimes I bounce from thing to thing to thing because I get so many ideas and then I work on them for a couple of weeks and I'm like, yeah, it kind of lost its ping for me. So I'm going to move on to something else, right? And I have to be on guard about that because especially because, you know, when that happens, especially now, because I work with, you know, other people, I set my ship in a certain direction. And then when I suddenly shift gears, I mean, it has ripple effects. So I have to be really careful to meter that. I mean, my desire, of course, is to be the developer. And so now that I'm sort of aware of that, my ambition is always to bring something to a point of, if I get to a point where I'm ready to abandon something, my ambition now is to quit with purpose, to say, I am abandoning this project and I'm going to explain why I'm doing it. It's because I tried it and I just don't think there's potential here. It's not because I've lost my interest. It's because there's not really the kind of value here I thought there was, and I'm abandoning it with purpose. And just that simple act has helped me stay more, I think, on course and not be as much of a drifter.
One of the key areas that we're really interested in is curiosity. And I love that you wrote a whole chapter about being fiercely curious as one of the practices that helps you do those three kinds of work, but meshing in particular, and to find your path as a developer. So my first and maybe most important question for you around curiosity is, why is it so important to brilliant work, to producing a beautiful body of work at the end of your life that you can be really proud of and not, you know, look at with any regret? Why does curiosity matter?
Well, it's important because, as you know, in your work, I mean, our tendency as humans is to fossilize around assumptions. Our minds are wired to help us survive. So our minds are constantly nexting, constantly predicting what's going to happen next, right? I mean, that's kind of what we're learning about the way the mind functions. And as a result of that, once we have experiences that are reinforced multiple times, it's easy to fossilize around assumptions. And when we fossilize around assumptions, we start to limit our options. We limit our perspective. We start to only focus on the things that are going to help us survive, which is really helpful when you're out running through the woods and trying to avoid dangerous animals. But it's not so helpful when you're trying to do mind work or knowledge work, which is what many of us do on a day-to-day basis. Because when we fossilize around assumptions, it limits our perspective. It limits the inflow that we have of stimuli and ideas and the kinds of things that forge new neural networks in our minds. Instead, we just continue to reinforce those existing neural networks. So curiosity is important because it forces us outside of that comfort zone and forces us to have to deal with potentially contrary opinions, things that may challenge some of our existing assumptions. It forces us to have to, as Stephen Sample calls it, to commune with great minds and to have to wrestle with big thoughts. And all of those things are important if we want to be effective at growing in our capacity to do knowledge work, to do mind work. If we're cranking out widgets on the factory line, there's nothing wrong with that. But curiosity in that case might actually not be a good thing. Like, I wonder what happens if I pull this lever, right? Not a good thing.
Right. We talk a lot about how, as kids, we get rewarded for curiosity, even though it can be incredibly exhausting being with a child who's incredibly curious. But we really get rewarded for being curious, and it's actually the only way that it's a key way that we make sense of the world and figure out how things work.
Right.
But as adults, we actually get rewarded a lot more for knowing as opposed to asking. And, the knowledge fuels assumptions, fuels knowledge. And it's a perpetuating cycle unless you disrupt it with curiosity and unexpected questions and a real willingness to be open to having what you believe to be true challenged and disrupted.
Absolutely. My ambition is to become more and more aware on a daily basis of my own ignorance. I figure if I can on a daily basis make myself more and more aware of how little I know, then I'm successful in my curiosity. Because it's easy for us to get to a point where we feel like we know about all we need to know in order to function, in order to do our job.
Yeah.
But if on a daily basis I can measure and say, I feel slightly more ignorant today than I did at the beginning of the day. Yeah. I feel slightly more ignorant now. That means that I'm venturing out of my comfort zone and exploring new topics and trying new things. And I think that's a good thing. We're not comfortable with ignorance because I think we like to wear this mask that shows us to be confident and that we're capable of making our way in the world. But I think if we all would just take those masks off for a few minutes and instead embrace, like you said, that childlike curiosity. And this isn't, willy-nilly, frou-frou, touchy-feely stuff. I mean, this is for real. This is about not just our survival, but our ability to thrive as creative professionals. We have to embrace that curiosity because those who do are the ones who discover new problems that need to be solved that maybe others aren't even looking at yet. And that's where the real value lies in the marketplace.
You talk really thoughtfully about habits and practice, and I'll use the word rituals as a means to get to the great work or to do the great work. Mm-hmm. As it relates to curiosity, can you share with us some, specific tangible curiosity habits or practices that you really lean into daily, weekly, monthly that help you stay meshing and stay curious and conscious, not only conscious of your ignorance, but finding ways to close the gaps in your knowledge and understanding of things that you might not know much about right now?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I have a regular study time. I mean, that's one practice for sure. And I talk about this in The Accidental Creative. And I talk a little bit more about it in Die Empty as well, that I have a regular time when I study and I have a regular queue of stimuli that I go through. I have websites that I scan that I think are thoughtful, that provide, interesting tidbits of or nuggets of wisdom that I scan on a morning basis, but then I throw them into a tool that I use to later go back and purposefully process and read and think about and study and meditate on. I was up until very recently using a tool called Instapaper, mm-hmm. Which is a tool that allows you to queue up articles for reading later. Instapaper sold a short while ago, and I've since then switched to a tool called Pocket, which is very similar in concept, but it allows you from any number of RSS readers or you know, websites or whatever to add, basically add an article to a reading queue or a video or an audio file or whatever to a reading queue. And then later you can go and you can read it, you can star it, you can tag it. I use this kind of as the core of my online processing for all of the information, all of the things that I do during my study time that are you know, that were originally found online. So Pocket is a fantastic tool, highly valuable tool to me. Instapaper was before that, and there are things about Instapaper I loved that Pocket doesn't have, but I found Pocket actually to be first of all, it's continuously being developed, which is great. And it's more, I think, deeply integrated now into a lot of other tools. So I reluctantly switched, but I did switch over to Pocket.
So it sounds like you do a scan, mm-hmm. and from like a morning scan. And from that scan, you're flipping stuff you want to dig into more deeply into Pocket.
That's exactly right. And then during that study time, I sit down with my queue with Pocket and I go through that queue and I read and I process, and I have a notebook handy. I still use index cards. I've actually got in front of me right now, I've got an index card, and I take most of my notes on index cards. And then if there's something that I absolutely must remember or something I want to go back to, then I transfer them to Evernote, which is the tool that I use online for taking notes and capturing snippets and things and for research and whatnot. So if something in Pocket catches my interest and I say, oh, this is interesting for a project I'm working on, I'll tag it, but then I'll also throw it into a notebook in Evernote that I then go back and scan as I'm working on that project.
Can you tell us a bit more about how long is that study time? And I appreciate that how you do it won't work for everyone necessarily.
Sure.
But how long is it? Is it once a week? For how long? Do you have, you know, are there any rituals around it? Because I think that it's such a throwback to, again, being a kid when you have to do your homework or you have, you know, study time set aside, which again, I think is a practice that, a valuable practice that we lose as grownups.
Right.
And I think it does kind of impede our curiosity, and not just our curiosity, but how we apply what we learn from our curiosity as a result of our curiosity.
Absolutely. Well, I have an office in my home. There's a sofa in the office, and I make coffee in my French press every morning, and I take it to my office and I sit on my sofa in my office, and it's an hour for me of reading, of processing, of writing, of thinking. It's an hour every morning. So typically I'll read or study or do whatever for about half hour to 40 minutes. And then I'll do about 20 minutes of writing or reflecting on what I just read. And I mean, for some people it's longer. Like Keith Ferrazzi, who wrote a couple of great books on networking, said that for every hour he spends studying, he spends an hour processing what he read, which is fantastic. You know, but I think for me, the important thing is making sure that I'm not just reading for content, but I'm reading for application.
Right,
I'm reading
right.
to make sure that whatever it is that I'm absorbing, and I don't care what it is, I don't care if it's a, you know, something from a website or if it's a book or whatever it is, that I make sure that I'm thinking about how is this going to apply. I mean, Zig Ziglar famously said that he read 3 to 4 hours every day of his life, right? So I think it's different for different people. For me, everything flows out of my ability to stop and think and study. Everything that I do comes out of that. All of the consulting I do, the speaking I do, the writing I do, all of that, all the products I create, everything comes from that study time. It's the source. It's the source of the river for me.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not intentional about that, then I notice everything else in my life starts to fall apart. So I have to be intentional about that practice, because if I'm not, then I'm not bringing myself fully to what I do. Eventually, I will find that I become less and less effective. So for me, it's like anything else, right? I mean, I wouldn't leave my relationships with my kids until after everything else is done. Like, that just has to happen. And in the
right.
same way, if I want to be effective in my job, I have to carve out space early in my day to make sure that I'm setting myself up to be effective throughout the rest of my day and the rest of my week.
You mentioned the concept of problem finding several times in the book, and it's linked to curiosity. And I'm just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what the difference is, because we talk a lot about creative problem solving or problem solving, and that seems to be, you know, the panacea, find the creative solution to the big juicy problem. But this notion of problem finding is really interesting, and I just wanted to have you tell us a little bit about that and what its connection is to curiosity and how it's different than problem solving.
Well, problem solving is I see, you know, dissonance in my environment and I go out and I resolve that dissonance. I mean, that's problem solving. Problem finding is going out and finding those areas of dissonance that exist and not just being confronted with them and solving them, but actually going out and finding those areas of dissonance. And that's a different skill in some ways, because, you know, a lot of people are only focused on the things that are directly in front of them in their immediate sphere of influence. But when you venture out and you go out looking for problems to solve, I mean, that's really where a lot of the value is created. You have to go out and figure out what is it that people need that they don't even know that they want yet. And I think that in many ways, I think that we have to do the same thing if we want to really create a lot of disproportionate amount of value in the work that we're doing. We have to be willing not just to problem solve, but to problem find, to go out and look for areas that people don't even realize are a problem yet.
Or they're not sufficiently painful that they're screaming about it yet. It feels like, yeah, in our innovation work, we look for those pain points or tension points where it's like, you know what, no one's complaining about it yet because the pain's not sufficient enough to do so. But if we identify it early enough and can come up with some kind of solution or a new service or idea or way to engage them that addresses that pain point they haven't even recognized yet, that's really magic.
That's right.
You say at one point in the book, when you stop growing, you start dying. And that was a real, I'm like, wow, that's powerful and confronting, and it's really provocative. And so I just wanted to know or get your perspective on why it's so important. I'm going to quote you for a minute.
Okay.
Why it's important for us to, quote, make a personal commitment to lifelong personal innovation through skill development, risk taking, and experimentation. Why is that so important? And what do we risk if we don't make that commitment?
Well, I think, you know, if you don't use muscles, they go away. I mean, it's a simple law of physiology, right? Of the way that our bodies are functioning. The same way, if we don't develop our capacity to stretch, to grow, to try new things, then we begin to wither and die as well. I mean, and we see this over and over again. How many people do you know who get later in their career and they're just kind of coasting it out? They're just riding it out until retirement. They can't wait to stop working. Why? Because work has lost its luster. It's lost it doesn't have the same ping of challenge that it once had. And a lot of times that's because people have stopped saying yes to opportunities. They've stopped stretching themselves, stopped growing, stopped pursuing their curiosity, all of these things we've been talking about. And so they've begun to atrophy. And that's the way that it works. That seems to be a law of nature, is that if you aren't growing and stretching yourself, then you eventually will die. Now, the counter of that is you can stretch yourself too much and
yes,
you can also die,
right?
So there is a sweet spot in there. You have to find the sweet spot, but you can't default to comfort at the expense of contribution. And unfortunately, so many people tend to do that.
Well, that's a great segue into one of my final questions for you, because in reading this, going through it a couple of times, it's the challenge that you set forth for us is powerful. It's provocative. It's a real lights a fire, definitely. And I was wondering, does it really have to be so much suffering to do the great work? And it sounds like all kinds of really hard work to do good work. And I wonder, like, how do we make sure that we do the brilliant work, we build a beautiful body of work over the course of our lives, and we die empty without also dying exhausted?
Yeah. And I tried, you know, early on in the book to counter that idea by, you know, talking about the Japanese word karoshi, which means death from overwork, which is unfortunately something that's become more and more common. The goal of Die Empty is not to get people to a point where they're gasping exhausted over the finish line every day. That's not the goal. The goal is to make sure that you're not leaving your best work inside of you because you're deferring it until tomorrow, because you're not developing your skills, you're not pursuing curiosity, you're aimless, so you don't really have a sense of a through line or why it is you're doing what you're doing. You're not self-aware, or you're allowing ego to shape your actions instead of confidence and adaptability. I mean, these are all things that, you know, you can easily set your life on autopilot over the course of time and allow ego to drive your decisions. And you get to age 60 or 70 or 75 and you realize, I have spent my entire life defending some kind of self-perception out of a need to feed my ego. And in so doing, I have abdicated a big part of what I could have contributed in my life. So it's not about gasping over the finish line as much as it is making sure that these hidden forces aren't robbing you of contribution, so that when you look back on your life, again, you can say, I don't have regrets about how I spent my time, because I didn't allow forces like ego or fear or self-delusion to prevent me from making a contribution. Instead, I did my best to examine all of those areas of my life on a regular basis, so that I was putting myself in the best possible position to do great work.
Todd, I'm so glad we spent an hour together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Todd's new book, Die Empty, is such an important reminder that we need to use our time well and work with a sense of urgency and diligence and live with a sense of wonder, curiosity, and a commitment to action. So my question for you is this: what do you need to do today, tomorrow, next week, next month to start building that beautiful body of work and to live and love more fully and to die as empty as you possibly can? Personally, I'm committing to reading more, watching less, starting now, and of course, staying curious. For more information about this week's guest and lots of other Curiosity content, please visit us online at curiosityinc.com, or you can follow us on Twitter at CuriosityChat. And always feel free to share your thoughts with us. We love getting email at curiositycast@curiosityinc.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay curious. I'm Karen Ward.